7. Sorry for that, I was muted. The Public Service Commission will be the first to present, followed by the Department of Public Service and Administration. I will therefore invite Professor Fikeni to make his opening remarks before the presentation by the Commission. Professor Fikeni, the floor is now yours.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. This is Henk Boshoff, a Commissioner with the Public Service Commission. I will be standing in for Professor Fikeni today, Honorable Chairperson. Professor Fikeni is in Mpumalanga. He is having a meeting with the Executive Council of that province today. And so he's unable to attend today's meeting of the Portfolio Committee. So with your permission, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, I will do the short introduction. Honorable Chair, the presentation we are about to make is a study that focuses on a high-level assessment of the effectiveness of continuous employee development in the public service, taking into consideration the fourth industrial revolution in a continuously changing environment. Now, Chair, the reasons for bringing this presentation to the Portfolio Committee are twofold. Firstly, we are bringing this presentation to the Portfolio Committee as part of our reporting mechanism to the National Assembly. But secondly, Chair, and more importantly, it's also to enable the Portfolio Committee when it meets with relevant departments on skills needs, skills assessment in the public service, to also enable you and to empower the Portfolio Committee with information, empirical information based on a study that we've conducted on how to address these new skills development demands in the public service. Now, Chairperson, although the National Development Plan has identified the skills deficit in the public service, we must also acknowledge that the environment is continuously changing, and specifically with the introduction of the fourth industrial revolution, that must be kept in mind at all times. So although the Public Service Commission cannot identify all the skills needs for departments, because those needs are department specific, we would like to advise departments to remain adaptable when identifying these skills needs. And the presentation will elaborate on the recommendations. Firstly, the findings that we've made through the empirical research that we've conducted, but we are also making specific recommendations that departments need to consider when identifying these skills needs in a Dr. Kulufelo Sidibe, she's a deputy director general in the Office of the Public Service Commission. And with your permission, I'm going to request Dr. Sidibe to take you through the presentation. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Um, Thank you very much, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, members of the Portfolio Committee, and Dr. Boshoff and other colleagues from various departments. Let me also take the opportunity to thank the Deputy Minister, because I can see she's present with us. Chairperson, may I please just check if you can see the presentation?
Yes, I can see.
Thank you very much. I will then proceed. Dr. Boshoff has already indicated the purpose of the study. Okay. Very briefly, I will take the committee through the background, the objectives and methodology, as well as the prescripts that we looked at, and then we'll proceed to the conclusion. Abuti Thabi, please mute that side. Thanks. In terms of the background of this study, it's important, as Dr. Boshoff has indicated, to know that training and development, its main purpose is to facilitate the acquisition of new skills and knowledge, but also to enhance existing skills and knowledge so they are relevant. Part of this, we are looking at changing employee behavior in the workplace. In particular, in the public service, the purpose of training and development is meant to support the administrative reforms and modernization of the public service and the state in general, and for purposes of ensuring that service delivery is enhanced and improved. In this particular study, as mentioned by Commissioner Boshoff, we looked at the high-level assessment. We did not do a skills audit of each and every department, but we were looking more at the trends analysis from a policy process. We also they have taken into account the impact of the fourth industrial revolution in development. The key objectives of the study, mainly it was to look at how departments were utilizing the skills levy and the types of training that they were identifying for their employees. We also wanted to look at the influence of 4IR in how departments choose different types of training and how training is actually provided by those departments. We were also looking at the extent to which human resource management is effective and efficient. And on the basis of that, we would propose intervention. In terms of the primary data collection, we targeted all national and provincial. We've achieved more, but 82% is a very high number, so we can rely on that. The instruments were sent to HODs, who then had to work with the human resource development and human resource management units to complete the instruments and send back to the PSC. In terms of secondary data, we look at the prescripts, we look at other grey literature in terms of various government departments, frameworks and reports, and then we also look at academic literature. In this particular slide, we are just giving a highlight of the prescripts that these particular prescripts because the relevance of these are outlined. Goals and objectives. In the public service specifically, training and development is built into the performance management and development system. If we implement the PMDS as intended, but linked to the PMDS is what we call the personal development plans, the PDPs, wherein employees and their supervisors are supposed to outline the employees' personal development needs. And these are identified on the basis of any deficiencies that would be identified through the PMDS system. But what we are not indicating maybe in this slide that we address in the report is that over and above the PDP, departments are required to compile what we call the workplace skills plan, where the developmental needs of the institution based on its mandate and priorities are outlined, where the common employee development needs are also captured in detail, and these are submitted to the relevant CTAS. Now, the benefits of continuous employee development are multiple, but at the level of an individual, we are looking at employees who, when they have been developed, they do develop the confidence to do their work when they are assured that they have the required technical expertise to do the job. When employee skills have been improved, we also note from literature that people tend to be motivated more to do more. They are more productive because in the process of doing that, their chances of career development are enhanced. And the employer in return wants to retain those employees because they have trained and developed them. We do know that no employer wants to keep somebody who is not performing and delivering. There is often loyalty on the part of the employees who feel that the employer takes care of their career developmental needs. But in return, the employer benefits immensely from a productivity and performance perspective. In terms of the fourth industrial revolution, the literature the pandemic was not just an era where we started noting the 4IR, but I think we noted these areas early in the 2000s, but for a very long time, I don't think a government, apart from having websites and giving people computers and all the likes, we were exploiting the benefits of 4IR. So we have seen that in the past couple of years, the workplace, there have been attempts to introduce information technology in the workplace to improve internal communication, to improve the management of performance and other operations of businesses in the back and the front line services. And the challenge, however, with the rapid adoption of 4IR is whether the South African government is ready to embrace and to adopt 4IR in full. I think during the pandemic, what has come to the realization of the PSC is that in many instances, a lot of the platforms that we are currently using, such as Teams, and many other platforms which are actually embedded within Microsoft and other ICT infrastructure that we buy or pay licenses for, we have not been using, and we started exploiting these things when we were confronted with COVID. So the concept of 4IR, especially because of the pandemic, it has been embraced by many people. However, there are several challenges that we cannot take for granted. And some of these challenges, if I can indicate, they relate to lack of skills and appropriate tools of trade, lack of skills and maybe fear of changing amongst members of the public service, especially the aged, those who are close to retirement, very much comfortable with doing everything on paper, black and white, and meeting people face to face. And but apart from that, the challenge with the tools of trade tends to be associated with the hierarchical manner in which government tends to operate. In the public service, we are very quick to want to say people from middle management up to senior management, they qualify to receive laptops and other types of information and technology assistance devices and benefits. And those who are below those ranks, they either still operate on paper or they have the majority of the beneficiaries of public services may not have access to modern technologies that would make it easy for them to access government services, apart from the fact that we are still talking about expensive data and others. There are also concerns that the rapid adoption of 4IR, if not well thought and planned for, will result in job losses and security breaches of state information and private information of people, especially in our healthcare centers and in other government functions where people's private information like IDs and others are required. Now, in terms of the key findings from the study, taking into account what the literature says about the benefits and the challenges of 4IR and the benefits of training and development. In terms of the assessment of the effectiveness and efficiency of resource development processes in the public service, we found that most departments, they have human resource development policies and workplace skills plans are submitted annually as expected. And very few departments did not necessarily have the HRD policies. In the case of departments that had HRD policies, we found that there is a common practice of reviewing those policies. However, the regularity would range from 1 year to 3 or even 5 years. And we do know that the world changes daily. So a review of 5 years might not necessarily be helpful, but at least those departments do try to review. In terms of the assessment of the efficiency and effectiveness of human resource development processes, again, a lack of capacity in departments. In some departments, including the very big departments, our service departments like SAPS, Correctional Services, we are looking at health and education, you will find that the HRD unit has got 1, 2, at most 3 employees, of which one of them is an administrator. It then becomes very difficult for these people to be on top of what is required by these institutions from a human resource development perspective. There were instances of lack of alignment and compliance, especially in how we deal with the PDPs, personal development plans. as a result, there would be instances where, you know, people go on training, but the training is not necessarily helping the department. Maybe it is what the employee wants, but training and development in the workplace, it should not always be about what the employee wants. It should be about what the institution wants. So in many cases, we also found that there was no post-training evaluation by supervisors to determine whether the training was addressing the identified gaps. So that is also not helpful. But budgets remain a major issue in many departments. Even in departments that seemed to be organized in terms of how they approach human resource development, in the sense that when there are budget cuts, the very first area that gets cut is the training and development budget. So if you had a large group of people who needed to be trained in a specific area because of emerging priorities for the department, the numbers would be drastically reduced, if not completely cut. Specialized training and development in some areas, it requires registration with professional bodies. It requires the mentoring of candidates. And in most cases, this is not provided for in the training and development budget because it is 1%. So 1% for some departments is a lot of money. For some departments, it's very little. Small departments with limited budget, that is a very small amount. And if that institution requires specialized skills, that is not provided for. So employees are left to fend for themselves. However, in some departments, some professions, departments are assisting people to register with professional bodies, and we know the registration entitles people to training that is provided by these bodies. So in terms of COVID, we are aware that this resulted in many service providers having to convert most of their training provision or programs into online. There were, however, challenges that were noted in the sense that when you expect employees to work remotely and to access training online, and you have the majority of your employees below the MMS or middle management not having access to laptops, data, and other issues, they could not be able to. So during the 24 months that the country was dealing with COVID, very little was happening in the training space, precisely because many service providers were not ready for online, and those who were able to, government itself was not able to enable its employees to attend because of lack of access to relevant infrastructure. The other challenge is with supply chain processes. We have to comply with SCM processes, even when procuring training. And this tends to take a very long period, and as a result, some of the training is not provided as expected annually. The poor attendance of training and participation. This is often not because of poor planning, but I guess it has something to do with how we prioritize issues as the public service. There are instances where nominated people do not attend training. They don't attend training because they are expected to go deal with crisis or what a department considers to be a priority. When people simply don't attend training and the employer did not stop them, we have a way of recovering the money. But where the employer says, please go and attend to this, then we find the next available person in the corridor, we send them for the training. And maybe that person does not need the training because the training is meant for people with specific needs and specific responsibilities. There are also instances where employees will decline to go on training for reasons that there is a portfolio of evidence that needs to be submitted, and they do not think they will have the time to do that. And when they do not complete the portfolio of evidence, their training is considered incomplete and the employer has to recover the costs of the training. And those would be the reasons why people would refuse. It then becomes a challenge for the employer to say, you cannot force people when they already tell you in advance that I do not have time to do the portfolio of evidence, which requires me to work at night and over weekends. So these are the challenges that departments and HRD units are facing. In most departments, they do conduct the skills audits and they do regular skills assessments to make sure that the PMDS and the PDPs are well informed. And in most departments, the identified skills from the PMDS are incorporated in the workplace skills plan, which is good. And in some departments, there is no clear process followed on how they identify training needs that go into the WSP, the workplace skills plan. So we have variations, but I think the majority of the departments, they do try to make sure that the skills training and development process is properly managed. So the monitoring of the implementation of the PDPs, this is the responsibility not just of the HRDs, but of any supervisor who has somebody reporting to them. So this particular area, we found that it is not always properly monitored, because once people complete the PDPs they submit, it gets incorporated somewhere. The tendency is to expect HRD to run with it. Most departments, they rely on the NSG and other service providers for training. And when procurement processes come into play, this is where the challenge starts. But institutions that have their own training institutes, such as the SAPS Academy, the agricultural colleges, these institutions tend to do much better because everything is in-house. And we are not saying all departments must have this, because the departments that I just mentioned, SAPS and agriculture, these are very huge departments with large numbers of employees. So in some departments, management would demand that supervisors must monitor the implementation of the PDPs and take responsibility for assisting HR to implement. And in others, it is really left to the line manager and the employee concerned. And hence, at the end of the financial year, people say, I identified this, it was not done. And when this is not done, the day you want to discharge a person from the employ, because they are not able to perform, you cannot, because you have not addressed their PDPs. So it is important that a PDP, it must have the training needs that are agreed to with the supervisor, and those must be linked with the responsibilities of the employee and the expectations of the employer, so that the employer is always covered in terms of dealing with skills gaps. The utilization of the skills levy, what we found is departments do comply with the allocation as provided for in the DPSA directive. The only challenge that would be experienced is when there are budget cuts, because the allocation is done at the beginning, and when there are budget cuts, you know, the 30% ends up becoming nothing, if any, or the 50% that they must use. But what goes to the CPES do go to the CPES. The influence of the 4IR in terms of our study, we have picked up that there are institutions that have already, even before COVID, started dealing with the issue of digitization of certain processes and procedures in the workplace. Most departments that reported, responded to our study, they indicated that 75% of their officials have got access to computers and they use various technology platforms. That 75%, some of those technology, the computers, I'm talking about the old-fashioned desktop that you cannot take anywhere, it sits stationary in your corner in the building. But at least the majority of the employees do have computers. But having said that, there were a few departments that took a decision a long time ago to begin to phase out desktops. As these desktops become obsolete and so forth, they began to buy laptops for almost each and every employee. So those departments are ahead, but we still have those that are behind. So the 25% of the people who do not have laptops, most of them would be in the lower ranks. This is where the challenge is in the public service, and we will deal with that. The preparedness for working remotely. Again, I have alluded to this, that employees who had laptops already, they were able to work from home. And those who did not during the lockdown, even if we had what we call remote working, you could not expect them to work because they could not log in, they could not do anything. If anything, they would write whatever notes that they were writing. Those who were not even given cell phone allowances, the employer could not even expect them to be engaging with the employer or with the public. That's where the challenge is around the preparedness in terms of working remotely. But we do indicate that the pandemic is also one of the areas where we were just able to see how hierarchical ways of working can be problematic, in the sense that departments were very quick to say all the employees who were pre-qualified to get cell phones and to get laptops, give them a bit of an allowance to be able to get data. And only afterwards did they realize that the majority of the people who did not have this pre-qualification were excluded. So when they were at home, they were literally at home, not because they did not want to have work, but because they did not have the tools of trade. Departments like environment and tourism in various provinces, we do give examples there. You know, these departments were honest, but what we have noted is that when they started realizing that the decisions that they were making were working against the department, they then began to correct this. But this for us is the issue of preparedness when we operate based on the old decisions that are hierarchically based. The departments of health, for an example, they have automated their PMDS. We are aware of other departments that have done the same. And their skills development tools, they are also automated in a sense that at the click of a button, they know which skills needs which employees, who has attended, who has not, and so forth. And it makes it very easy for them to also manage performance. The in-embracing for IR, departments did acknowledge that the focus cannot just be on training and development. There also needs to be focus on how departments operate overall. And in terms of the operations, we're not just talking about remote working, because people have fallen in love with remote working. I don't know whether it's because they were more productive or they are able to do other things from home. There is a lot that needs to change in the department, including how the employer monitors and supervises people who are working remotely and so forth, if a department is implementing such. But there is a lot of other operational issues that needs to be attended to in most departments to make sure that the beneficiaries of services do not suffer. Again, for IR, for it to really, really be implemented fully, it requires reliance on data and electricity. And we do know the challenge with data and electricity. Data is still very much expensive in this country. Employers are giving people very, very limited amounts of money, even where there is a subsidy. Electricity, we do know what happens when there is load shedding. It's a problem. It's not just a problem for those who are working remotely, it's also for problems for those who are sitting in the buildings. So reliance on electricity also exposes the workplace to the risk of load shedding and affects service delivery especially one is in the middle of a meeting or you are providing a service that requires access to certain networks and servers to be able to provide a service to the employee. To the employees and to the citizens. But there are also other service departments like Home Affairs and Health. Most of their operations rely on walk-ins, and so they really cannot offer certain services virtually. And we are giving this examples not because we are saying other departments can. The Department of Education, for a start, how do you expect a grade 1, 2, 3, or 4 child to attend school remotely in rural areas? It's not going to happen. And we've also seen challenges even with our high schools and whatever. So technology and other things in certain instances, it becomes an add-on. It cannot be a replacement for human touch and physical presence of people at the place where a service is provided. Instances of 4IR people want to adopt it rapidly, it does result in what we call the loss of touch, you know, the human touch. Employees get disconnected from the employer, from each other. Government departments and their employees can be detached from the public that they are serving. So sometimes it's better to see the plight of the people that you're serving than to try to deal with them via phone and other means. I think in this slide, we were just showing an overall of how departments are evaluating training and whether the training does have benefits or not. So I would like to move quickly from this slide because I think it is self-explanatory. It is just a way of indicating the extent to which training and its impact are evaluated. And again, I would like to skip this particular slide, but just to indicate that when we assess the impact of training, we don't just want to tick and say these people attended, they signed the training register. The evaluation wants to see whether there is an improvement in the performance of the person. We want to see if there is an improvement in service delivery. So if training and development are properly managed and properly implemented and they address the real skills gaps, we should see an improvement at an individual, institutional, and system level. There also needs to be an improvement in employee behavior. You know, it cannot be that people are being incapacitated and then we are not seeing a change in behavior. And this is not just about sending people to attend training on conflict resolution and emotional intelligence, but any training that also improves the technical capabilities of the people, it also needs to lead to an improvement in how they behave in the workplace. When you're confident, you're able to engage, we need to see that we have invested in you, invest back in the employer. Training, it needs to address what we call the scarce skills and critical skills. So the questions that may be asked are, what are departments investing in if on a continuous basis they will still be saying there is a scarce skill in this particular area? Yes, we do know that certain training and development must start from universities, but what are these departments doing to engage with universities and TVETs to make sure that they train? Why are they not issuing bursaries to poor students from different challenge backgrounds to channel them into particular training areas where there is a skills shortage? There are departments that are doing that, but sometimes there are departments that are not doing that and they hope someone else is addressing their skills needs a challenge. For example, the Department of Health, it was able to address skills shortages in the forensic analysis and forensic toxicology area. And in this particular program, they were offering bursaries. They were offering a number of training programs to young people as a way of channeling them into particular areas. And those young people, they tend to stay with the employer because they have benefited and they actually see a career for themselves. So the public service regulations, they do allow for even that. So on the basis of really our analysis as the PSC, we then make very basic recommendations. One of those recommendations is that departments must review their training and development policies and make sure that they are adaptable. You can't say our policy decision is that we review our policies every 5 years. When the environment changes, you have to change that policy to accommodate what is required. But in the review of those policies, departments need to take into account the requirements of 4IR. Because sometimes for institutions to be 4IR ready, they need to invest more resources on infrastructure and tools of trade. Then after that investment, you can expect your spending to moderate at a particular level. But without that initial investment, it becomes a challenge for institutions to move into the 4IR. The 1% allocation, we are saying it must be ring-fenced so that when there are budget cuts, departments do not use this 1% as the orphan of the budget. This is where we take the money away. By doing that, the departments are incapacitating themselves as well. It must also be reviewed to accommodate additional costs related to training and development, such as attending conferences, professional registration, and membership, so that also these issues are dealt with in a consistent manner. It cannot be that in some departments, engineers and auditors and others are assisted to be members of professional bodies, and then in other institutions, they are not. There is the need for the public service to ensure consistency. And we do note that the 1% is not a very huge amount, but in the process of reviewing that 1% and how it is allocated, we want to believe that as part of professionalizing the public service, government can make provision for assisting everybody or for not assisting everybody so that there is consistency. The DPSA, especially to deal with the issue of membership, it has to issue a directive on the management of annual membership fees. We are aware that educators pay for themselves to be members of SAGE. Most people in the health profession, they pay for themselves. Many other people in the engineering and accounts and all the likes, they pay for themselves. But there will be those differences like we have alluded to, where you will have certain people in HR, certain people in audit and finance and engineering who are assisted by the employer. And these challenges create inconsistency, and they have the potential to undermine the professionalization of the public service. Departments must guide their employees about the training needs of the employer. It is all well and good to say an employee and the supervisor must agree on the personal development plan of the employee. Our view as the PSC is that the personal employee development plan, it can consist of the specific training needs of the employee. It must also consist of the needs of the employer that are not negotiable. Everyone, if the employer says these are the new priorities, this is the direction, so that the employer also has a level of control over the PDPs. But in addition, departments must engage with service providers, including the NSG, about their training needs. You cannot have training needs that you're not communicating to service providers and you expect to find the service out there. Service providers, including the NSG, need to be appraised of the emerging training needs of the employer. And if a training program is not addressing the needs in full, feedback must be given so that such programs can be improved upon. there is a need to prioritize and to upscale internships and learnerships. This we are raising because when budget were cut, this is one area that was most affected in government. Excessive reduction of interns and learners. And in some departments, there were no interns or learners for a very long time. And this on its own was undermining the Skills Development Act and the Skills Development Levies Act. But it is also undermining government's commitment of creating work opportunities for unemployed young people to develop work-related skills, but to also capacitate those people who are coming from matric and the TVETS programs below NQF level 6 or 5 so that they can learn trades that are relevant to the skills that are required in the employer. But having said that, I just want to note that starting from 2021-2022 financial year, we have begun to see departments going back into the reintroduction of internships and learnerships in large numbers, which is commendable. Departments need to prioritize and make provisions for the required systems and technological infrastructure to facilitate the adoption of 4IR platforms. And this is where our ICT people need to come in. We do not expect people in HRD or HRM to have a thorough understanding of what is required to go for IR. They must make the demands, and the ICT specialists in the public service must be able to assist government to deal with the required technological infrastructure. Training and development, it is facilitated by people who are said to be specialists in human resource management or human resource development. But these people, their training does not include ICT. ICT is highly specialized. So for these groups of employees to have a thorough understanding of the ICT requirements of the employer, they must work very closely with ICT. So here we are expecting our colleagues in ICT not just to act as technicians and troubleshooters on computers and network, but to also begin to have a thorough understanding of human resource management and development broadly within the institution so they can add value. HR units must ensure that their policies are relevant and there are guidelines in place. And this must be developed in collaboration with IT so that the issue of dealing with ICT or the fourth industrial revolution and human resource development goes hand in hand. And in so doing, departments would also be able to identify skills needs that are totally new and that are not within their traditional list of what they had in their portfolios. In conclusion, we would like to say it is important to acknowledge that there has been progress in the coordination of training and development in line with the demands of 4IR. And we thank COVID-19 for that because it has accelerated an area that was moving at snail pace. However, the findings show that there are inconsistencies, silo approaches, and gaps that need to be addressed in order for departments to be fully equipped for the new changes. Whilst the need for the fourth industrial revolution cannot be avoided or denied, and maybe it cannot also be delayed, attention should also be given to the reality that 4IR is indeed blurring the lines between people and technology, the physical, the digital, and the biological worlds. And there are mental and all sorts of issues that come with these things that I think emerging literature is beginning to deal with. But most importantly, 4IR has the potential to widen the existing socioeconomic equalities in our society, especially if the poorest of the poor are not properly provided for by government. It is therefore crucial that the transition to 4IR is carefully managed in a responsible and sustainable manner in order to avoid its unintended consequences. I think with this presentation, Chairperson, we are tabling it for consideration discussion. And I would like to stop at that, and maybe Dr. Boshoff has got one or two words to add. Thank you.
Honourable Chairperson, I think that Dr. Sidebe has adequately addressed the findings and the recommendations that we would like to table before the Portfolio Committee. And we are inviting the members, Chairperson, to make inputs with regards to this study that was conducted by the PSC. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Let me now invite the Deputy Minister of Public Service and Administration to make her opening remarks before the presentation of the department. Then we will discuss both presentations thereafter. Honorable DM, the floor is yours. Deputy Minister Majage.
Good morning. Sorry, Chairperson, I was muted. Good morning to all. Good morning to the members of the Portfolio Committee. Good morning to the commissioners of the Public Service Commission, the CEO of the Public Service Commission, officials from the Department of Public Service and Administration, members of the public. I wish to welcome the presentation that has just been presented by the Public Service Commission on effectiveness of continuous employee development in enhancing capacity and service delivery in public service. It's in our interest to capacitate the state, to capacitate the public servants, so that at the end of the day, we can be in the position to manage to run a capable developmental state that will be in the position to effectively and efficiently deliver services to South Africans. Chairperson, in terms of that presentation of the Public Service Commission, what I would actually like to add is that as we look at fourth industrial revolution in terms of capacitating public servants, we need to actually take cognizance of the status of IFMS, the Integrated Financial Management System that we have been waiting for all the years. We need to understand where we are in terms of the integrated financial management system. We need to know as to how far it is in terms of its conclusion. And why it's important is because this is the kind of system that has for ages made it a little bit impossible for public service to really manage to be a little bit ahead in terms of digitization of government, modernization of government, and just connectivity across government, because of the fact that at every point when government departments are setting up systems, they would actually be informed that maybe they need to delay a bit because of the IFMS. Let's look at the IFMS, how far we are with the IFMS, where are we getting to with the IFMS, so that we don't actually talk in a way that is parallel in terms of what needs to be done for the state. And this morning again, Chairperson, we will actually look at public administration norms and standards, compliance monitoring framework that the Department of Public Service and Administration will be presenting this morning. The Office of the Standard and Compliance is mandated in terms of the Public Service Administration Act 2024, that is PAMA, to, amongst others, monitor and enforce compliance to public administration norms and standards, and has developed the monitoring and evaluation framework with the objective of achieving compliance with public administration norms and standards. The framework serves as a foundation to guide the monitoring of compliance within public service and administration, and outlines the compliance principles and processes, a compliance monitoring model that the Office of Standard Compliance intends to complement. The objective of the framework is to address poor adherence to regulated prescripts. According to the Auditor General, failure to comply with legislation is one of the root causes of material instances of non-compliance and audit findings. The AG has consistently, Chairperson, reported that much of this non-compliance was not detected by existing internal controls, which is quite a pity, because we know that annually all departments also do the internal audits that should actually be the ones that manages to assist with all internal controls. The framework, therefore, intends to foster and encourage compliance by guiding the monitoring of compliance with the minimum norms and standards. The framework has been consulted extensively in six provinces, namely Limpopo, Eastern Cape, Northwest, Mpumalanga, KwaZulu-Natal, and Northern Cape, as well as with selected national departments. A report thereof has been submitted to the Minister of Public Service and Administration. Compliance monitoring by the Office of Standard Compliance currently focuses on national and provincial departments, with a view of incorporating municipalities in future, once we have one public service, as the Public Administration Management Act and the Office of Standard Compliance regulations apply to the three spheres of government. The early warning system, which is one of the Office of Standard Compliance's mandate, is tasked with being is being developed, and it is intended to be interrogated with other intended to be integrated with other public administration systems. The Department of Public Service and Administration is in the process of appointing a service provider to develop these systems. A compliance assessment methodology involving early warning indicators will be used to pick up early signs of non-compliance for timely interventions. And it is in our interest, and Honorable Chairperson of the committee, to really manage to come up with a plan that will actually manage to respond accordingly to non-compliance across government and in national government and provincial department, in the provincial departments. I am with a team from the department under the leadership of Ms. Renesha Naidu, who are going to actually in full, in detail, take us through the presentation. I thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable DM, Renee, can you take the platform?
Thank you so much. Thank you, DM. Good morning to DM. Good morning to the Chairperson of the committee and honorable members of the committee, as well as commissioners and colleagues that are present. Chair, I'm just going to try and share the slide. Thank you. I hope you can see it clearly.
Yes, I can see it on my side.
Okay, thank you. Good morning again. So the presentation outline, we've tried to set out the background and the purpose and the mandate and what informs this particular framework, as well as the problem statement we started with, and the framework itself, and the recommendations that come out. In terms of the purpose and the background, I think DiEM has touched on quite substantial parts of the presentation, so I'm going to talk to it quite quickly. The Office of Standards and Compliance was recently established within the organizational structure of the Department of Public Service and Administration, as envisaged under Section 17, which establishes the Office of Standards. One of the key functions of the Office of Standards, amongst the many that it has, is to monitor and enforce compliance within the public administration with minimum norms and standards, as well as norms and standards that exist across the administration. And the administration includes the public service, national and provincial departments, as well as municipalities. So there's a long-term vision to make sure that compliance is monitored across all three spheres of government. In the 2021-2022 financial year, which was last year, the Office of Standards developed a draft framework for monitoring of compliance with public administration legislative framework, which I'll refer to as the framework, which then sought to strengthen the monitoring of public administration norms and standards with the purpose of trying to reduce non-compliance by departments. As the development of the framework was embarked on, there were other policies that had to be considered in the process, the largest of which is the policy framework that governs government-wide monitoring and evaluation systems, as well as the Public Audit Act. In terms of the content of the framework, Chair, and I want to emphasize that the framework is still in the draft stage and it's being finalized in this financial year. But what the framework does, it seeks to define concepts that we use in monitoring of compliance. So it looks individually at the definition of compliance, which is then the adherence to laws and regulations and rules and prescripts. But it also then looks at the what it means to be monitoring compliance. And there's specific reference to the supervision and the investigation that needs to happen to track compliance, as well as to encourage the right behaviors to happen and to promote compliance. So compliance monitoring then is done on an ongoing basis. It's not a once-off activity. And it seeks to identify any breaches in prescripts, in laws, and improper or unauthorized activities. In this context, we look at compliance monitoring as an identification of poor compliance and full non-compliance. So there's instances where there's partial compliance and there's instances of complete non-compliance, and this looks at both those areas. The main objectives, like DiEM has said, is to consistently lift the levels of compliance to minimum norms and standards and to develop strategies that encourage an improvement in compliance. We also enable evidence-based decision-making, and we assess performance in areas particularly critical to the effectiveness and efficiencies of departments. So the framework itself outlines the core compliance considerations, what enables compliance, and what requirements are required for an environment that makes it conducive to compliance. The framework then also looks at what is the need for compliance monitoring. And as the DiEM has said, non-compliance, usually the net effect of non-compliance is the inability then of the state to provide optimal services. And one of the things that has DiEM has again raised is that there has been AG reports which have detected that there are not enough existing internal controls. So by the time the AG gets to the office, things that should have been detected had there been internal controls would have been detected. And that's largely our focus in the Office of Standards, is to look at what we can do to put in better measures within the system so that the outcomes when the AG gets to those institutions is much better in terms of compliance. The Office of Standards has also done many engagements through this process on areas of non-compliance. And the outcomes of all of those engagements is a position that the OSC takes in terms of how it intends to do its work. And the first target that the OSC seeks to achieve is to foster and encourage compliance by guiding departments and providing support. In terms of its own organizational functionality within the OSC compliance and monitoring functions, the first thing that the OSC seeks to do is to manage and develop the frameworks and guidelines for monitoring of compliance and reporting on public administration norms and standards, which is this particular provision framework. The second thing that this particular unit is tasked to do is then to evaluate those public administration norms and standards and to provide guidelines to do that. The third element of work that is being tasked with the unit is to manage then the support system that gets put into departments to enable departments to comply, and then to develop quarterly and annual compliance and compliance monitoring reports. And finally, and this is a task that's spanning over the next 2 to 3 financial years, is to develop and implement an early warning system throughout the public administration. And I'll talk to that in the later slides. So Chair, with regard to the compliance framework and the concept conceptualization of that, again, it stems from Section 17, and it's built on the premise that we seek to strengthen government and government processes. We also seek to ensure that systems and processes within government are supported to ensure compliance. In summary, the framework has 6 chapters, and the 6 chapters include a chapter on some background and legal frameworks and principles that are adopted. We also look at the theory behind all of these processes, and we look at what the roles and responsibility for the unit within the OSC will be in this particular process. We also deal with the governance mechanisms and arrangements that will encourage compliance strategies. And in the 5th chapter, we look at how DPSA will monitor this compliance. And in the 6th, we deal with the methodology that was used. In terms of the principles that governed this regulatory framework, we've aligned with the government-wide monitoring and evaluation framework principles, which basically are to advance the principles of transparency, accountability, participation, and inclusion, and to ensure that there's a rights-based culture promoted, to consider and support key national, institutional, and local government, local development priorities. The main aim is also to ensure that ethics and integrity are not compromised, and that the expectations and the aim for support of these and the use of these results, and also to ensure that the methodology is sound, as well as to ensure that there is integration within government systems that is sustainable and cost effective. To that extent, the OSC compliance monitoring model that's been adopted is you have the setting of compliance requirements, which will then be followed by the promoting of compliance, monitoring of compliance, and then how do we respond to non-compliance? And the OSC is predominantly focused on encouraging voluntary compliance to norms and standards, whilst recognizing that if that and all other support interventions don't work, there are stronger measures for enforcing compliance through enforcement plans, as well as compliance orders that the OSC is empowered to do. In terms of the framework committee members, the framework encourages full compliance, but there's also a note that's being made that for full compliance to happen, there are 2 main precursors to that. And that requires that decision makers and executive authorities and those responsible for compliance are supportive of improvement measures. So when improvement and enforcement plans are provided, there must be support and buy-in on those processes. There is also a requirement that if there is compliance, even though enforcement or improvement plans have been put in place and there's continued non-compliance, consequence management must be followed through on. Therefore, in an effort to promote regulatory compliance, one of the factors or three of the factors, main factors that the OSC has determined that are really fundamental to inducing and promoting compliance is that departments and institutions and officials must be aware and understand what the legal frameworks are. In many instances, there appeared to be a lack of common understanding of implementation of norms and standards, which then affected the implementation of that. There must also be a willingness of these departments and these employees to comply. And third element is that departments and employees must be able to comply. So as the OSC does its monitoring process, and this is its internal controls, there have been processes put in place within the OSC to deal with matters that are either brought directly to the attention of the Office of Standards and Compliance through direct means or indirect where there are substantial issues raised in AG reports or other compliance reports or matters that are raised by the Commission that need intervention by the OSC. The OSC then will investigate to establish the root causes of the non-compliance and submit those reports together with recommendations and steps that need to be taken by the institution. And then the OSC is expected to monitor whether those directions have been followed and that guidance has been followed through on to mitigate the non-compliance. And if it's found that there still isn't any improvement, there is a process to submit an enforcement plan, which then compels departments to start to put in place progressive measures to improve compliance. And that again is monitored, and if it's still not complied with, then compliance orders are issued by the Office of Standards and Compliance to those institutions. And again, if there's still non-compliance after all of these measures have been put in place, then there is a process to deal with non-compliance of the institution by reporting those to Parliament, the relevant EA, the Public Service Commission, as well as the Minister for Public Service and Administration. And there's already processes in these relevant laws that regulate non-compliance by individuals, and that includes then consequence management of discipline. In terms of the framework itself, it also talks to the compliance monitoring cycle, which I've depicted here, and to a large degree we've canvassed through the other slides. But fundamentally, a large part of this compliance monitoring cycle is about trying to get departments to voluntarily comply and putting in systems to assist departments to do that. So the approach that we have taken in the Office of Standards is not to be a sanctioning approach. It's more to collaborate, to support, to persuade departments to see the benefits of compliance and to engage on measures to improve compliance in terms of institutions. The proposed strategy that have been identified is an identification of the creation of compliance systems, processes, policies, etc., to understand compliance triggers, to look at compliance risks, to classify that, to do awareness and training, to assign roles and responsibilities to people, and to monitor to have monitoring mechanisms, to do periodic reviews, to do compliance audits, and to do compliance reporting, and to ensure that documents are retained. In terms of the large work that's being done behind all of these frameworks, is the development of an early warning system. It is a project that, as DiEM has indicated, we've started. It's the idea is that we should have a system across the public administration, and to allow that once this information is in place, it should make detection of non-compliance much easier and much quicker, and we should be able to Chair, I think maybe I was lost for a bit. Good morning, Chair. Chair, I'm not sure if you can hear me now.
Recording in progress.
So I was talking about the early warning system, Chair. Was that where you last heard me?
Yes.
Okay. So Chair, the work that's being done on the early warning system is basically to create a system that takes a risk-based approach where the OSC can flag institutions that are struggling with compliance and create processes for intervention and support. That system is currently being developed through the procurement of a service provider to map business processes and then to develop a particular system that can interface with existing system architecture and also to interface with the public administration institutions. The framework, Chair, also deals with roles and responsibilities of persons and institutions that deal with monitoring and compliance so that we don't overlap with other institutions and we leverage on what currently exists. So as DiEM said, internal auditing processes and other processes will be leveraged on as we do our work in the OSC. But this framework is being finalized and Chair, it is intended to be used by both the OSC for its internal purposes, as well as to support institutions in monitoring of compliance themselves. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, honorable members. I invite you now to discuss both presentations. Can members who want to speak raise their hands on the platform? I see Honorable Gondwe, Honorable Mutsipe, Honorable Maneli, Honorable Mugweba, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start with the presentation from the Public Service Commission and allow me to thank the PSC and the DPSA for the presentation. but I'll start with the Public Service Commission. You know, the presentation was all about the study, and they indicated in the presentation that although 80% of national and provincial departments took place in the study, and they had more provincial departments taking place in the study than national departments. So I wanted them to please confirm some of the national and provincial departments that did not take part in the study, and also indicate whether these departments provided reasons for their non-participation. And then coming to PDPs and performance improvement plans that public servants are expected to complete at the start of every financial year, I would agree that they are somewhat more, you know, they're somewhat of a tick box exercise. Having been a public servant myself, even at an SMS level, you find that, you know, a common excuse for not meeting, you know, the training needs that you've identified in your PDP or your PIP is that there are budget constraints or limitations. And at some point you have to ask yourself if you were not required to complete these PDPs and PIPs for compliance purposes. So I wanted to find out from the Public Service Commission to what extent were budget constraints or limitations identified by departments as an impediment to providing you know, the required training and skills development. And then I note that their study was comprised of two aspects. So you had the self-administered administered questionnaire, rather, and then you had that desktop review of legislative and policy framework. So the questionnaire was sent only to DGs and HODs and not employees. And I wanted to find out how were they then able to verify that the information in the responses provided by these HODs and DGs was, number one, accurate? And don't they think that had they involved, you know, maybe a sample of public servants, employees, you know, they would have gotten a fuller picture of the situation around, you know, this training and development? And then they stated that one of the findings that they made from the study was that few departments indicated that training and skills development assisted in addressing the identified scarce and critical skills. Were they able to establish why this is the case? One would have thought that, you know, training and development in all departments will be used to address or plug the skills gap or deficit, you know, in respective departments. And then were they able to get an idea from the study how often public servants are expected to attend training and development that is related to, you know, capacitating them when it comes to compliance with the, you know, the existing legislative and policy framework? And now, Chair, turning to the DPSA. I have one major concern with the framework. When you look at the challenges, some of the challenges that we're currently experiencing in the public service, some of these challenges, they boil down to one issue, and that is the issue of non-compliance with policy prescripts and norms and standards. As a case in point is the backlog in the number of disciplinary cases in the public service. And these challenges, you know, come at a great financial cost to the ordinary citizen, you know, and so I'm worried that it the framework advances a supportive approach to ensuring there is compliance, and I think the time that time for a supportive approach has long gone, and we need to get tough on non-compliance in the public service. Otherwise, we will never get the public service that we want to get, that is efficient and that is capable. We need to really start sanctioning and penalizing public servants for non-compliance. And I'm worried that this framework is still talking about a supportive approach to ensuring that compliance, you know, there is compliance rather in the public service. you know, I would have thought that the framework would start attaching, you know, consequences from the get-go in matters of non-compliance. And it talks about attaching consequences at the tail end when all the damage has been done, you know. And well and good, I take the point that, you know, issues of non-compliance can be reported to Parliament and other, you know, relevant bodies. But it's been done. It's been happening, and we've yet to see tangible changes within our public service. So that is a major concern for me with this framework, is the fact that it doesn't attach any sanction or seek to penalize public servants for non-compliance. I think the time for being supportive and is long gone. There's too much damage done. As I said, some of the challenges that we're experiencing have come at a great financial and sometimes even a physical cost, because we don't see service delivery happening. And as a result, it's affecting the environment and the circumstances under which our people, have to live. I thank you, Chairperson. That's it from my end.
Honorable Mutipe.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I would like also to welcome the presentation that has been presented before us. And I've got a concern here, Honorable Chair. The report received is saying the environment is changing. So do you considering rural areas in terms of the skills that is needed? As all the time, they are behind of everything because there is still huge challenge for 4IR. You are now modernizing service, but most provinces are not coping. Only urban areas are progressing. And then which criteria is going to be used in terms of PMDS as there are still shortfalls as we speak? And as you reported that this 4IR will be implemented to all employees in terms of PMDS, or do you include all categories or specific category when coming to the assessment of that PMDS? And then when you introduce any program, don't you take note of the budget first before implementation? That is why some areas will be in trouble, because they will not be involved. Then it's when rural areas are up, comes in, because they will be the first to suffer. And then when employees refuse training, it will not affect their PMDS, making them not to qualify since they are not trained. It's now that you have challenges of scarce skills when you modernize 4IR in other departments. Didn't you experience it before? And then the last, we as the portfolio committee, we wish to have this system in all provinces and without any failure of data, electricity, and budget allocated to, and to work effectively and efficiently in all 3 years of government. I thank you, Honorable Chair.
Honorable Maneli.
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to members of the committee. Let's also appreciate the presentations, Chairperson. I think I've got a number of questions to ask both presentations. In terms of the PSC presentation, Chair, I would like to check whether is there anything that the study has identified or anything new that came out that is not depicted in the National Development Plan? Because, Chair, the NDP outlines the issue of public service challenges, amongst others, looking at stealing and re-stealing of the public servants. Hence, I wanted to check if there's any other new thing that the study could come up with. And then also, Chair, In terms of the human resource development, have they identified any outdated policies that are not working currently? And coming to the issues that was raised in the recommendation of the reinforcing of the 1%, I think in terms of the recommendation, they say it should be reinforced. So does this suggest that there are departments where this is not happening? Because I thought that it is a must that a 1% should be reinforced for development of workers. Lack of budget is cited, Chair, as a challenge for training when there is that regulation that's supposed to be there of 1% that is reinforced for training and development. Hence, I'm saying that probably I need to be clarified as to whether are there some instances where it's not happening. Amongst other issues, Chair, it was mentioned that we've got workers that are at a lower level who still use their desktop computers. So I wanted to check as to then how are they planning to deal with the challenges raised by that category of workers at that level. Chairperson, in terms of the training needs, I also want to check if there's a measure to determine if indeed all the training needs as identified by the public servants are being catered for. Those will be my questions, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mkweba.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and good morning, DM, and honorable members and colleagues. Chair, let me welcome the two presentations by the DPSA and the Public Service Commission. Chair, I've got a few straight questions, in fact, to the DPSA. And regarding the compliance management. Chair, the first question to the department is how will the department strengthen consequence management in the public service? Because the presentation clearly, has explained the lack of compliance in terms of our departments. And then, Chair, the second question, what are the new suggestions that does the department have that is in the pipeline to strengthen consequence management? And the last question, Chair, is compliance monitoring not a matter that departments have been doing already, Chair? Those are the three questions. Otherwise, in terms of the Public Service Commission, I've been covered by honorable members. Thank you.
Honorable Nduli.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Welcome to the meeting, and I would love to join my colleagues in welcoming the presentations. And I'm partly covered to most of the clarities that I wanted to seek. Honorable Manelli did mention the chunk of the workers that still use their desktop, whilst others are having laptops. And for me, at 25% of the entire workers having no laptops is quite a huge number. And I wanted also, Chair, to cite that we are still a developing country, and as a developing country, we still suffer a lot of teething problems. Now, the fourth IR is a revolution. And apparently the revolution can't be completed overnight. And I wondered, hence we are still having a lot of challenges as South Africa. You name your ESCOM, you name the data, you name the network itself. You see, some can be affected by data, whereas in the remote areas, the entire network is still a problem. It's still a problem. There are places where across the road there is network. Then you come on the other side of the road, there's no network. Now, if we say we working at home, that means it's not that easy for all of us. As I've mentioned earlier on, of the teething problems of our country. And remember, the disadvantaged, the previously disadvantaged areas are still far behind. We are not equal at all. Now, I wanted to check, Chairperson, to say, in terms of the fourth IR and the rapid adoption of it as a country, is there any consideration of phasing issues bit by bit, with the understanding that it can't be a one size fits all? Then moving to the Department of Public Service and Administration, to say, having been covered by my colleagues on some issues, but I wanted to emphasize on saying, a lot of framework have been exposed. The workers has been exposed to a lot of framework, but it is clear that the compliance, the non-compliance, is still an issue. For me, we've got your consequence management. You've got this and that. Workers are the public servants are guided by mostly by the Batho Bill, but the non-compliance is still an outcry. But for me, Chair, do the department consider putting major disciplinary actions that will sort of draw a line to a worker, whether you are in or out? If you choose the non-compliance, you know that you're out, and if you comply, you know that you are in. Do they consider? I mean, I don't think that we can still call that harsh. If we are pushing, if all the frameworks that have been they've been exposed to are sort of pushed on the deaf ears, do they consider to put such a disciplinary measures? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Ntuli. I will now give the floor to Public Service Commission to respond to questions directed at them. Thereafter, it will be the Department of Public Service and Administration responding. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I will just make a few remarks before I request Dr. Sidibe to respond to the questions in detail. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, there exists a trend among national and provincial departments that when it comes to research projects conducted by the Public Service Commission, that the information that we request tend to come in slower. That has been a trend that I think we've also reported to this portfolio committee. Now, what we have also seen is that because the Public Service Commission also has a visible presence in provinces, provincial departments tend to cooperate more quicker when we request for information. And that is why you see provincial departments, in most cases, not all the departments, but in most cases, responding to our research questions. There still remains a challenge with regards to some national departments, and that has been a trend that we've seen over the years. With regards to budget constraints, I think the presenter, Dr. Sidibe, has pointed out that, you know, when there are budget constraints in a department, the first thing that departments tend to cut on is training. And that is an aspect that we've also highlighted in the presentation that the committee needs to consider. There will always be budget constraints, especially in the current economic environment that we are currently operating in. Budget constraints will remain in the public service for the foreseeable future. Departments, when they start with their budget process, they tend to cut on training and so on, which remains a concern, and that we've also pointed out. The Honourable Members are correct with regards to rural areas. Rural areas...
Chairperson?
What is it now?
I think my question was more around to what extent. So out of the 82, not 82, but out of the departments that actually responded, I wanted to get an idea of how many of those, indicated that, budget constraints or limitations were an impediment to training and development. Thank you.
But they are not through with responding. You should have waited. There's another one who's going to come in. Dr. Boshoff was just making some preliminary remarks, responding here and there.
Thank you, Chair. Noted.
Thank you, Chair. So with regards to rural areas, I'm in agreement with the Honourable Members that there are still challenges in the rural areas, and obviously departmental offices in the urban areas are prioritized, and that is something that departments need to look into. This research report, research study will be shared with all the departments, and it is a challenge that we've identified and something that we feel departments should address to provide, to also prioritize rural areas and not only urban areas. The Honourable Members are 100% correct. But what we are trying to emphasize in the study and in the findings that we have tabled, Honourable Chairperson, is that we are now operating in a continuously changing environment, and we are saying that departments need to be adaptable when identifying skills, and obviously identifying skills in the rural areas is also critical. With regards to the NDP input, The Honourable Member is correct, Honourable Maneli, that the NDP indeed identified skills deficits in the public service. Again, Honourable Chairperson, I want to emphasise that we are trying to indicate to the Portfolio Committee that there is a changing environment with specific reference to the Fourth Industrial Revolution that we as the Commission, and I think society in general, became more aware of during the COVID pandemic. Catering needs of public servants, therefore, need to be adaptable and identified in terms of the changing environment. I'm now going to request Dr. Sidibe just to present some of the technical aspects that were raised in some of the questions. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Boshoff, Chairperson and members. Let me start with the issue of whether departments that did not complete the questionnaire, they gave reasons. They did not give reasons. We did follow up with a number of departments as we normally do. I think at a particular point in time when you want to complete the study, we stop with following up and then we proceed to finalize the analysis and the report. The departments that participated in the study, we do list them in the report itself. So those that are not listed, it means those are the ones that did not participate. But for us, getting reasons for why they were not submitting was really not a priority after all the follow-ups that we did. The PDP's budget availability and compliance. When PDPs are completed as a matter of compliance, it's black ink on white paper. So it can be anything, a squiggle or whatever, report writing, even for somebody who doesn't really need report writing. So often that is what happens when a PDP is completed for compliance purposes. Hence, in my discussion, I did indicate that it's important that a PDP does not just deal with what the employee wants or they want to write down. It has to be what is agreed with the supervisor, but there also has to be an imposition of certain programs that are required by the employer. So that those are actually not negotiable. They are generic across a range of employees who need them. So when budget constraints are there, they will definitely also impact on those individual employee matters. But maybe just to try to address the issue of how many departments alluded to the issue of the budget constraints. We will have to go back to the data, but in the report, we talk about the majority or most departments indicated budget constraints. So there will be very few departments. I think a rule of thumb would say the majority or most would be anything between 60% and 90% of the respondents would have complained about a budget constraints, because we know budgets have been a cut over an extended period of time. But if the Dr. Gondwe wants a specific response to that question in terms of how many, we can go back to the data which we capture in a fairly accessible manner and extract some of those responses that relate to that to see which department specifically said what. In terms of the questionnaires, how do we verify that the information that is provided is accurate when we are only relying on the submission of a questionnaire that was sent to the Director General? The instructions when we send, we are very specific to say, we are sending this, you're making a departmental submission, and the unit that will assist you is your Human Resource Management and Development section. They are the custodian of the focus of this program, the workplace skills plans, the PDPs, the PMDS, so they should be able to assist a director general to complete properly. And the reason why we specifically send to directors general is to make sure that they take responsibility for informing their employees that they have to input correct information. And from where I am sitting, when we ask for information via the DG's office, we are assured that the information is accurate, because at any given point in time, we can make available that completed instrument back to the HOD. And if there are any inaccuracies, then the HOD will have to account, because we did not send the questionnaire to a practitioner or an SMS member in a unit, but to the DG. So that process also saves us a lot of time, instead of having to find out who is in charge in this section, deal with them, and then go back and ask the DG. So it is the quickest and the clean way of trying to obtain departmental information instead of individual employees' perspectives. And I think based on the report that we provided, the positives and the negatives, we are comfortable that people were not necessarily trying to spin what they submit to the PSC. And how often are public servants expected to attend training? In terms of the directive on compulsory employee development for SMS members, which was issued by the DPSA 2018-19, if I'm not mistaken, the directive requires that SMS members should attend training 18 days over a three-year cycle. The reason why the directive was issued links up with the concern that I have already alluded to, that says people are often identified to attend training, especially at the level of your SMS and maybe sometimes the middle managers, but closer to the training, when there is an urgent priority or an issue that is considered crisis, it is often the employer who will take the first move of withdrawing that person from the training and replacing them with someone else. So through this directive, DPSA was trying to also manage those instances where senior managers in most instances miss out on training opportunities or are withdrawn from training in order to attend to crisis. So crisis needs to be dealt with in a different manner, and we want to believe that if you plan for training properly, it should be easy for SMS members to go for training, because we do not believe that if an SMS member wakes up dead or terminally ill, the crisis will not be handled. Somebody in the institution will handle it. And I think how we deal with training and crisis management and other urgent matters should always take that into occasion, that if the member was not there, there will be somebody who manages the crisis. So if the member has to attend training because it's important, let them go attend training and let someone else deal with the crisis. So the directive from our part, it was a very good initiative to try to assist the challenge that SMS members often found themselves in. Commissioner Boshoff has already alluded to the issue of rural areas and 4IR. Let me deal with Honorable Motsepe's question around employees refusing training and how they qualify for PMDS and others. I think the relationship between training and PMDS is a little bit complicated. It's not a straight forward matter, but in a nutshell, when an employer expects an employee to attend training, it must be clear from the onset what the training is. And the member needs to attend the training, and the employee's performance must be assessed after the training, so that if there is no improvement, incapacity can be invoked. But in the absence of the training, incapacity can be invoked. Again, training needs to be planned for properly. When an employer simply wakes up on Monday and says on Wednesday or next week Monday there is training on A, B, C, and D, here is, we call it a commitment form. I am paying 8,000 for you to attend this 1 week training with NSG or whatever. If you don't complete the training, I want the 8,000 back. Then the mode of planning and engagement in those particular instances is not proper. But if the training is properly built into the PDP, personal development plan, and that PDP is signed for, then there is no way in which a person can refuse to attend the training because they signed for that in the PDP. So it is a little bit complex in that respect. But I think the biggest challenge always comes in where the training is almost in ad hoc and there is a financial commitment that then scares people to say, if there is this requirement that I must submit A, B, C, and D or write a little test. You know, most of the training these days is not just a question of arriving, warming up the seat. There's tasks that people are given to complete that have to be assessed, and the person would be certified to have successfully completed the program. And those are the things that make people fearful. Hence, we are saying even the policies must be reviewed so that those issues can actually be built into the policies of the department. Is there anything new that the study, I think Dr. Boshoff has addressed this issue, but let me just give a little bit more detail and say, in terms of emerging literature around training and development, the literature tells us that it is no longer good enough for people to be trained in a singular area of specialization. People need to have diversified skills within a particular discipline or area of operation. But the literature also tells us that the fixation that we have with traditional occupations and careers is standing on the way of our capacity to reconceptualize traditional careers and occupations and to modernize them so that they can also be attractive to young people, but it is also preventing us from identifying new careers that may not have existed at a particular point in time. For an example, we do know that some of the modern careers in the areas of ICT did not exist in the past 20 years. We have examples of information technology security, cyber, what. These are new careers, but I think beyond that, outside of the formal academic professions, there are other careers that we are not necessarily exploring. I think examples would be those sorts of occupations that relate with what we can call coordination, designing, and information generation, and mining, and so forth. And these are the key areas that generally government is not also exploring. Hence, when we want people to come and mine large-scale data in government, we run to private sector companies. And sometimes we actually even hire overseas consulting companies because we are not exploring these areas because they look fuzzy and they do not fit into our traditional definitions of occupations and careers. So there are ways in which we can deal with this issue of careers, which the NDP would not have identified. I think NDP spoke about project management, policy analysis, implementation, and others, which were fairly still more within what we were comfortable with. But I think the depth of what we are seeing with 4IR and the little occupations that we see a lot of young people being marketers in their own right on behalf of companies without a middleman, these are some of the careers and others that we are not exploring. But I think in terms of 4IR, government generally is far behind. If you check on platforms like Twitter, and what is this space now, TikTok and all of the likes. There is very little that is happening that is being done on behalf of government or that is being done by government employees, because we are all busy with our traditional occupations of writing reports, investigating this, and training people. But there is really not enough capacity to enable government to communicate with people across boundaries. And these are some of the careers that we are not. Our ICT people are busy with infrastructure and with network connectivity and helping us to log into these platforms. But they are not into this media space, because we still want to formalize it into a particular job when there are little other pockets of careers that we see emerging from small entrepreneurs in the private, but some of those can also play a role in government if we reconceptualize the occupations that are required in the public sector. The outdated policies, we did come across instances where departments have said we have not updated our policies for the past 5, 8, 9, 10 years. That would be an outdated policy. A policy framework is supposed to talk to the issues of the principles, the priorities, in terms of the implications of the priorities and the mandate of the institution on training and development. And when a policy is outdated, the chances are we are still saying we want 5 accountants, when maybe we want one and then we want someone else in another area. So that's basically what we are referring to when we talk about outdated policies. But I think even in policies where a number of departments said they reviewed their policies 3 to 5 years back, I think when we look at what happened under COVID, one would be saying you should have already initiated another review process. When you look at the medium-term expenditure framework and others, you should already be reviewing your policies, because if there are new priorities that have an impact on the mandate of the institution, that on its own necessitates a review of the policy to make sure that you are spending your money on the training that is actually required or not. A quick one on ring fencing. The 1% is not necessarily ring fenced. It is a policy requirement that you must set aside that money, but it has not necessarily been ring-fenced in the sense that when there are viaments, the money that is sitting with the department, not the one that has been sent to CETA, it can be affected in the viament in terms of the reallocations. And this is what makes that part of that money that should go towards training and development to be susceptible to reallocation to other areas of need. The desktop and people who are still using desktops, how are we going to address this particular issue? Once an employer has procured desktops, they have a particular lifespan. The lifespan has to be exhausted before they can be called redundant, or I don't remember, there is a special terminology that the asset management people use. Departments have to phase out. I think with departments that we have found had already been giving almost all their employees laptops, those departments phased out the desktops. Once it reaches the zero rating of its value and usability, and it is no longer possible to update that desktop with new softwares and all of those issues, you then have to replace it with a laptop. But where they have done procurement of such equipment in the past 2 to 3 years, they have to allow. So it's a phasing out process that would allow the employer. But I think beyond those who qualify for the desktops is the question of how do we make sure that the other percentages of employees outside of the 75 who have access to laptops and desktops are also provided with tools of trade that enable them to be able to play an active part in the 4IR. Those are policy matters that need to be deliberated on with, I think, your national treasury, and your CTAS, because there is a range of other policies then that needs to be amended, your security policy, your loss control, and so many other policies. It's not just a question of giving people equipment. I think I have addressed all the questions, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Kulufelo. Is there any question that has not been answered, honorable members? So when you are silent, it means there is no question that is not
answered. Oh, fine, Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, there is no question that is not answered. Thank you very much. We are now going to deal with the minutes of the previous meeting. Mastole, can you flight the minutes?
Okay, Chair. Good afternoon to you, Chair, and honorable members.
Chair? Chair?
Hello?
Sorry to interrupt, Chair, but the DPSA has not responded. Chair, can you hear me?
Hello, Dr. Gonda?
Yes, I was saying the DPSA has not responded to some of the concerns and questions we have.
Such as, so that they zoom into those questions.
No, I had a concern about the fact that the framework was suggesting a supportive approach, and I indicated that I think the time for that approach had long gone, and we needed to ensure that, you know, it attaches consequences from the get-go, and not at the tail end when the damage has been done in relation to non-compliance.
Thank you, Chair. We can try and actually respond to Honorable Gondwe. Should I go ahead, Chair?
Yes, you can go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. Honorable Gondwe, your question has actually been noted that we need to get tougher on non-compliance and no to support, there must be sanctions. And I think it's sensible what you've actually alluded to. The comments on Queensland's management is noted, and the document will be strengthened in that regard. Queensland's management is regulated by relevant acts, like the Public Service Act, Municipal Systems Act, Public Finance and Management Act, and the Audit Act. It must be noted, however, that the Office of Standard Compliance recognizes the reasons for non-compliance, that the reasons for non-compliance may not be malicious or defiant, and this is why there is this component of support that is actually being brought into play. You also lamented about intervention being made at the tail end when there's damage already. But I think in the presentation that was made, it's been indicated that there will be early warning signal system that will be developed. And for now, we know that already within government, what is actually used for early warning signal is the internal audits that are actually utilized. So all of this will actually be strengthening a system that already exists within government. Well, I guess some of the questions had to do with the Public Service Commission and the concern of MS Motsepe, Honorable Motsepe, about rural areas is very genuine. What is important is that we need to just look at, in terms of technological advancement in rural areas, to look at the fact that for now in South Africa, almost every citizen, no matter where they are, they own a cell phone. As we advance technologically as a country, we are hoping that we will actually be in the position to advance, even in terms of internet connection across the country in that manner. Honorable Manduli has actually indicated that or lamented about internet connection and the fact that it's actually lacking or it's that much difficult in rural areas. And indeed, the situation is like that. And this is why at certain levels within government, what we are talking about is release of spectrum so that we can be in the position to have systems that have actually also managed to increase the speed of internet. So all of this, I think, will be progressively realized through processes that have actually been put in place by government. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Deputy Minister. We are now going to deal with the minutes of the previous meeting. Pastole, can you flight those minutes?
Okay, Jefferson, good morning once again to you, Chair, and then to honorable members. We've got about 3 sets of minutes, Chair. I will start with the minutes of the 18th of October, Chair. On page one, Chair. On this day, we're deliberating the Deputy Ball report, Chair.
Members, you are allowed to correct as we go, and you don't have to raise your hand when you want to make some correction. You just shout and make the correction.
Can you see, Chair, on page two now?
Yes, I can see.
That's the last page, Chair. Page three. Remember the deliberations were effected on the reports, Chair. That's the last page, Chair. These are the minutes of the 18th October, Chair.
Can we move to the next meeting?
Okay. We'll then require to adopt them, Chair, the minutes of the 18th.
Yeah, I want us to go through corrections first, because there are more than one set of minutes. Then thereafter, we will table all of them for adoption. That's my approach here.
Okay, sir. I am on the minutes of the 19th, Chair. On this day, once again, we were just adopting the reports, Chair. That's page one. That's page two, Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, I think in terms of the attendance, my attendance is not recorded there on the 19th.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's no sense.
Yeah, you were there. You were there, of course. Yeah.
Noted. I'll.
Okay.
And then page two, Chair. That's page three, Chair. That's the last page, Chair. I'll move now to the last set of minutes, Chair. The one of the 2nd of November. I'm on page one, Chair. We're getting a briefing from GPSA, PSC, and National School of Government, Chair. That's page two, Chair. Page three, Chair. At page four. And that's the last page I've ever seen. So
thank you.
Those are the minutes of 2nd of November, Chair. Thank you.
Can now we will table the first set of minutes, that is the meeting of the 18th, isn't it? For adoption.
Yes, sir.
Yes, any mover for adoption for that set of minutes?